To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. We're going to be talking about the environment today. It's actually one of the first programs we've done on the environment, so I think this is going to be interesting. What we're going to be talking about is fracking. Now, I and hundreds of thousands of others, if not millions, are very confused about this subject. I happen to live in the state of Colorado, which is a hotbed of the fracking debate. And our authors are also in areas where there is some fracking going on. So not everyone is right near it, but I think it does impact everyone, as we'll find out. So the authors that I have joining me today are Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald. Michelle is a veterinarian who practices in New York. And also, Robert Oswald is a professor of molecular medicine at Cornell University. So both of these folks have done some research and quite a bit of in-depth study into the subject. So we're going to be addressing that today. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, so the name of the book is called The Real Cost of Fracking, How America's Shale Gas Boom is Threatening Our Families and Our Food. So I think the first thing I'll ask, is this a meant to be alarming, or is it really that serious? Let's start with that question.
Okay, I'll take that one to start. No, it's not meant to be alarming, but it's I think the way I look at it is like a big red flag. It's going on all across the country in many states and even around the world. And no one has really taken the time, in my mind, to answer the questions that we ask in this book. Some really basic questions have been left unanswered, and I'm sure we'll get into some of these things during the interview. But until we've determined that people will not be harmed by this process, that their health won't be harmed, that their pets won't be harmed, that their food won't be harmed, then, I think we should stop and take the time as a scientific community around the world to answer these questions before allowing it to go full stream ahead as it has been.
Well, some people have said that fracking's been going on for decades, and so why all the alarm now? There hasn't been any kind of headline stories that, of communities like, toxic waste and this kind of thing. So maybe we could dive into a little bit about why. Why now? Only because it's expanding so rapidly. Is there anything pointing to the past that we should be focusing on?
Well, what you're saying is a half-truth. Fracking has been going on for decades. It goes on in a lot of different areas. In fact, the first gas well that was fracked was actually done in the 1940s. What's different now is not so much just the fact that there is a hydraulic fracturing, but the scale in which it's done. Back in the old days, it was done with relatively small amounts of hydraulic fracturing fluid. Now we're talking about millions and millions of gallons of fluid, and actually, in some areas, wells spaced a mile or so apart. So what has changed is the volumes. This is a much larger industrial process than what's happened in the past. And this has just been going on for about the last 10 years.
Okay. So the scale is what's changed. Out here in Colorado, we see a lot of commercials on TV supporting, fracturing. And it's basically, in my view, it's the industry trying to shore up an image and make sure that the public opinion is following perhaps what they want to see. So I don't see much in the debate except for grassroots people around the community, signing petitions, things like that. So is there anything that they're hiding, that they're trying to make you know, put under the cover, so to speak. What would you say about that?
Well, you see a lot of industry advertisements because they have so much money. It's, you know, it's sort of a David and Goliath thing. They have almost unlimited resources. We're talking about corporations that are probably more wealthy than any corporations in the history of the world. So they can get their message out there. So we hear a lot from them. We hear comparatively little from the other side because there just isn't the funding to, you know, be on the radio and television 24 hours a day in your face. But are they hiding anything? Well, the problem is how we look at problems. In, you know, when we point out, you know, health effects, they'll come up with some reason to say, you know, they're not caused by, you know, hydraulic fracturing or other aspects of the industrialized process. They'll always come up with a reason why it's not their fault. I think we've documented a number of cases where it's very clear that it is their fault, and, you know, we're just trying to get the message out.
Okay. Can you give a little perspective, each of you, about how you came together to write the book and what the perspective each of you have brought to the book?
Right. So I think I was the first one to start getting really involved in this. Both of us were concerned when we first learned about what is called compulsory integration or forced pooling up here in New York, because we are surrounded by people who have leased their mineral rights and in some cases their surface rights as well. So the law here is that if you are in a drilling unit that up in New York here, it's 1 square mile. And so if you're in that unit and 60% of that is leased, then you will your mineral rights will be taken from you, will be drilled under, and you're given a few options on royalties, but basically that is the law. So that caught our attention in 2009, and we started learning more about this whole process. And as I started learning more about it, because I'm a veterinarian, I became very interested in cases we were hearing about herds being exposed either to hydraulic fracturing fluid or wastewater and succumbing in some cases very quickly. In one case in Louisiana in April of 2009, half the herd died within an hour. And that was after being exposed to what we're told is hydraulic fracturing fluid that is no problem at all. It's just household ingredients and the chemicals that are used there. Most of it's water. Why would a 1,000-pound animal die within an hour after being exposed to that? The answer is that there are some very toxic ingredients in there, and Robert is the chemist of the two of us here. He can explain that a 1% solution may not sound like much to the general public, but if it's a pretty toxic substance that's 1%, it can be very, very toxic and can kill. So so that caught my attention, and a number of other cases did too. I started documenting, and we realized that most of the people, our friends and other people we spoke with, had no idea that this was going on and had no understanding of it. And we thought, okay, how can we best get this information out to the public? We thought of doing the scientific article, so we had a peer-reviewed article appear in January of 2012, but we quickly realized that a lot of people would never read a scientific article. Mm-hmm. They just would never do it, no matter how easy it was to read, and we felt ours was pretty easy. So that's when we realized we really had to get going on a book, find a publisher who was interested in doing this, and really get this out there, because that's, we feel, the hope is that this will reach many more people than that scientific article.
Yeah, I think that, to me, that sounds pretty reasonable. What do you think about the various areas of the country? How much of the country is affected physically, or where there's actual drilling going on? And should anyone who's not in a drilling state be concerned?
Well, I don't know the exact number. It's something on the order of 30 to 34 states that have, you know, the resource that can be drilled. They're not all being actively drilled at this point, but there are quite a few. Places like Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Wyoming, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, a number of others. Mm-hmm. And those people are directly affected. We are affected in many other ways, even if you're not in a place where there is active drilling going on. In New York, we have a lot of the wastewater coming to our landfills here and being disposed of in our landfills. They're buying a lot of water from our waterways to use in hydraulic fracturing, particularly in Pennsylvania. But then there are bigger unknowns about, what's happening relative to animals who are exposed. Are beef cattle making it into our food supply? And the question really is that a problem? We don't know. We'd like to find that out. We'd like to find out about that.
Michelle mentioned about cattle dying when exposed to it. So when you say we don't know, is it because there has to be more research, or as a chemist, how would you weigh in on the makeup of the fluid that goes into fracking?
Okay, well, let me say first that the case that Michelle alluded to, those animals were not part of our food supply. They were fortunately, buried or, otherwise disposed of, and not they were not sent to slaughter.
Okay.
You can't send a dead animal to slaughter. That's illegal. But what we have to we're concerned with a number of things. It's not just the hydraulic fracturing fluid. We know that there are toxic chemicals in that and it can be a danger, but there are also other things. The hydraulic fracturing fluid is injected below ground, typically around a mile below ground, and then it comes back up to the surface, but it comes back up to the surface with a lot of other things, a lot of heavy metals, radioactive material, et cetera. That said, that can then, that wastewater, which is millions of gallons, can then sometimes leak into our waterways. It has leaked into pastures, and animals have consumed it. Those are issues. The other issues are air pollution. We know quite a bit less about that. There's air pollution around hydraulic fracturing sites, but that's not the end of the story. There are also compressor stations, processing plants that are putting out quite a bit of pollution. We know some of the things that are in that benzene, toluene, et cetera. We need to know more about what's actually going into our air around those plants.
Mm-hmm. You've given some idea about where it takes place a mile below ground. Can you put that in perspective to where the water table is and whether drinking water is directly affected in some way?
Okay, well, that's sort of an interesting question, because that's what industry always alludes to and points out the safety of the process. Our drinking water is much shallower than that, so there is a layer of rock between where the fracturing takes place in many cases and the aquifer. But then we run into a few problems there. One is the well casing. You have to drill down through the aquifer to get to a mile below. So something does go through the aquifer, and the question is, does that stay intact or does that leak? The second thing is, in some cases, particularly things like fracturing of coal bed methane, fracturing takes place at a much shallower depth and actually can contact the aquifer. And then there are people who say that, there are paths through that what's called the impermeable rock up to the surface. And that's probably more an issue with natural gas itself contaminating aquifers.
Well, you mentioned that the water, or the treated water, comes back up to the surface, and it's shown up in grazing land and things like that. So, is it the case every time? Is it something? It sounds like the industry would have you believe that, oh, it's just, it's all down there, and then we suck it out, and we take care of it, and everything's left untouched, so I'm kind of curious what really is happening.
Well, okay, there are different levels here. One, for many, many years, or for the first 10 years, let's say, of this big process, most of the fluid that came up was then stored in open pits that were lined with plastic that often leaked. The industry is starting to get away from that, at least in Pennsylvania, where we're most familiar with it, and they're starting to store it in tanks. The problem is then, what do you do with it? You have millions of gallons of substances of variable toxicity, and you have to get rid of it somehow. There are a few wastewater treatment plants that claim to be able to take the toxic material out of the water. That's one way of doing it. Whether that's effective or not, I can't say.
Mm-hmm.
There are also strategies of putting it back down in the ground in injection wells, and we've heard about earthquakes associated with fracking. Well, that's actually more related to the injection wells, and that's been happening. Earthquakes have been happening at an enormously higher rate in places like Oklahoma and particularly Arkansas in the last year. They've also been seen in Ohio, and we even have an older case of an injection well about 10 years ago in New York that caused earthquakes.
Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com.
Is there any seismologists that have weighed in on, you know, what the ramifications of continued drilling like that is in these areas that are affected with the earthquakes?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, if we're talking about, I was referring to injection wells. One of the things I think we know less about is possible earthquakes that might be caused by hydraulic fracturing during the drilling process.
Mm-hmm.
That has not led to earthquakes the size of those seen in injection wells, but we do know that California, which just recently experienced the biggest earthquake in the last 25 years, is gearing up for an increase in drilling with hydraulic fracturing. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in such a seismically active area.
Okay. This question is for both of you. Michelle, I'd like you to address the issue of pets and perhaps humans as well. The ingredients that could potentially affect humans, do we know anything about what can happen in the state of our health?
Right. Well, I think the one group of chemicals that a lot of people have at least heard about are these things called BTEX, B-T-E-X, and that's these volatile organic compounds that have their origin in many different parts of this whole process, but they're benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, and those are really toxic compounds. If we just take benzene, it's a carcinogen, it's a mutagen, and it's a teratogen. And so teratogen, I think people probably know what a carcinogen and a mutagen is, but a teratogen is a substance that can cross the placenta and can affect the fetus and cause birth defects.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just benzene. If we go to the other chemicals, that whole group will have be able to cause problems with bleeding. And we do see nosebleeds, for instance. They do drop the platelet levels. Platelets are important in clotting. They cause upper respiratory problems. Again, you had asked about what about the symptoms in people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's what we call shale gas syndrome, the headaches. Another thing that's associated with that group of chemicals, there's the nosebleeds. There's another one. There are rashes, GI upset, and so on. And so when we have these sort of chemicals and people exposed to them, we are going to see these sorts of symptoms. With animals, what we have seen in our study and our first paper that came out was the main area that was affected was reproduction. And we feel that it's a little off the side here, but animals can be looked at as sentinels. And this is both food animals as well as our companion animals, our cats and dogs. They have higher exposure rates, and the reproductive rates are higher. They have shorter generation times. They're reproducing more. We're going to see problems with them over a much shorter period than we ever would with the generation time of people. So we saw a problem with reproduction. We saw increased number of abortions and stillbirths, failure to breed and failure to cycle, And that leads into another group of chemicals that are involved in this process, endocrine disruptors.
Mm-hmm.
We know that they are, some of the chemicals are endocrine disruptors. We're not sure of how many because we don't know of all the chemicals involved. But those are some of the effects in both people and animals.
So the one thing I think about it from what you've said so far is that it seems that in people, the threat is more the gas than the solution or the fluid.
Well, actually, that's an interesting point that you make there because, you know, we have to remember that word volatile. And so these chemicals are in the water, too. And, of course, they can also be in the air, many of them. But when you're taking a shower, if you're taking a hot shower, these chemicals are going to come out in the water and they will volatilize and people will say, you know, I just took a hot shower and I feel sick. I feel a horrible headache. I feel like I'm going to die. I can't breathe. And I just took a shower. I didn't even go outside where the air is bad. So why is that? Well, these chemicals, again, a lot of them are volatiles or semi-volatiles where they will be able to be inhaled. And they're coming off the water. They are into the air, and you're exposed that way too. The other symptom I talked about, being rashes, is also a direct incident of either water exposure or even air exposure. But people will talk about that they were splashed with some water, or they took a shower and they came out and they had a rash all over their skin. So it's really both water and air. I think what we have been seeing and concentrating more on, because initially we were concentrating a lot on water exposures with cattle, the wastewater, the exposure to that, the exposure to hydraulic fracturing fluids or drilling fluids. But what we quickly came to realize in our study, and we did actually a second study, which is under peer review right now. We did a follow-up a little over 2 years. And what we found is that the number of respiratory cases in food animals, at least, has increased dramatically.
Hmm.
And these are in areas, a lot of areas where there is a lot of air contamination from processing plants, compressor plants, or compressor stations, or in areas where there's a lot of flaring going on, as there is in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
People are not so much interested in the gas as they are the oil, and they're just letting the gas burn off. So there's a whole suite of symptoms that people could potentially be exposed to, all depending on what they are near. If they've got a well pad close to them that's active, they'll have one set of symptoms. If they've got a pipeline next to them or a processing plant or a compressor station, then they'll likely have other exposures.
Well, give an idea of the proximity. How far or close do I have to be?
Right. So for our first study, we had 24 cases, and those were all within 2 miles of some sort of infrastructure, either pipelines, compressor stations, wastewater ponds, drilling pads. That's certainly not to say that somebody who's 5 miles out or even 10 miles out couldn't suffer. All depending, I think, on a lot of factors, the wind direction, for instance. The elevation, if you're high or low, all of those are crucial especially for air. So, but with our study, with the cases that we had, it was within 2 miles.
Okay. So, if I'm trying to think rationally about this issue, I'd be thinking, okay, this has been a decade of expansion in this area. Why isn't there anything very clear cut to say? Every state has to take readings of the water supply on a regular basis to show parts per million of various contaminants, et cetera. So why isn't there any kind of study that shows a very clear demonstration that, well, here's the chemicals in this fluid, and here's what's happened, here's the parts per million in the water supply over time, you know? Anything like that showing the proof of what you're talking about?
Okay, we'll both answer this one. We have several cases, and one is described in the book, that are involved in the EPA hydraulic fracturing study where they're looking at water impacts on the water from this process. And you know, it was striking to me when I got the EPA results on these cases and looked at the number of chemicals they're trying to test for. And to be honest with the EPA, they are still developing testing for many of these chemicals. They simply do not have the assays for them. Industry is always a step ahead here.
Mm-hmm.
However, in order for you to go into court or for you to raise a question on a chemical, it has to have what's called a maximum contaminant level. Now, that's for water. It has to have a primary maximum contaminant level. So that's a level above which there are health impacts to people, below which their EPA considers there not to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I was shocked when I saw the results on several of these cases of mine that are in this EPA study, that for most of the chemicals being tested, there was no primary MCL. And that is an incredible statement to make when you are trying to judge the impact that these chemicals may have on the health of people. Because in these cases, there were chemicals that were directly involved with this process that do not have a primary MCL. So what does that mean? That means that it doesn't matter if it's in that water, and it doesn't even matter to what level. If there's no judgment on when a health effect may or may not occur to a person that's been standardized with that primary MCL, then the person who's being affected or impacted cannot do anything. So that is one of the, I think when you asked your first question about are we trying to raise alarm or what are we trying to do here, and I mentioned red flags, this is a huge red flag in my mind. Not only do we not know what all these chemicals are or what the mixtures of them might produce above or below the ground, we do not have primary MCLs on most of these chemicals. And I'll go the other side too. With air, there's something called effective screening levels.
Okay.
We need this basic data before we can even talk about whether this is going to be safe for our communities.
Now, why would they, it sounds to me like the EPA is giving a pass to the chemicals. When you say there's no primary MCL, is that they don't know enough about it and they're saying, well, but keep going until we find something? Or, I'm trying to understand if they have a reason behind the judgment they've made.
Well, you have to realize that in almost every area, chemical is considered safe until it's proven not to be. So, you know, any part of our life, you know, anything you buy in the store, if the chemical hasn't been tested, a chemical that makes up some product hasn't been tested, it's assumed to be safe unless it's shown not to be. So there are so many chemicals that we're talking about, and the work hasn't totally been done on this. And there really hasn't been, there still needs to be a lot of work done on better testing methods. For example, there was a study recently done from some people at the University of Missouri who, instead of measuring individual chemicals, turned the paradigm around and asked the question, are there any substances in water near, you know, wastewater spills that can affect the endocrine system? And they just used a bioassay. It basically had cells that told them whether there was something that in that fluid that activated an estrogen receptor, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was yes. It may not be possible necessarily to detect that or to know exactly what chemical that is, but we know that there's something that can affect the endocrine system in there. So the problem is that we have a lot of substances that can work at low concentrations that are not being picked up on these tests, and we need to know a lot more about that.
Okay, so for the individual, let's say that someone is in proximity to one of these drilling sites, and they don't want to wait a decade for the EPA to change their results or come up with a better idea of things. Is there anything that an individual can do or a group of people in an area?
Well, one thing that we found on our follow-up was that the people that could, that had the wherewithal, they left. They simply left their homes, in some cases abandoned them or or they're trying to sell them or have sold them. But they left because their health was paramount and they could afford to leave. In all of those cases in our study, their health has improved dramatically. And I have to put a little aside here in that it hasn't gone back completely to normal. In many of these cases, they feel their immune systems are not back to where they should have been, and this is nearly a year after moving. The second thing is one of the biggest impacts to these people is stress. And that was brought out in a study that was done last year. University of Pittsburgh interviewed a lot of people, and they found that stress was overall the biggest factor. And what we have found in our study is that several of these families, the ones that have moved are better, but now they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So that makes a lot of sense to us in light of the study that was done earlier and seeing what these people are going through. So the people that are still there, suppose you can't move, what do you do? Well, people are banding together and trying to get labs in or groups in, research groups in to do some testing. They are also, when they can afford it, putting air filters in their homes. They're staying in their homes and putting air filters in their homes. They're trying to get the drilling company along with the regulatory agency to approve it to give them water buffaloes so that they can take showers and they can do their laundry and all of that with water that is not contaminated, or the water quality is what it was before. And they're also trying to get the drilling companies to pay for bottled water. Oftentimes they are unable to do that for many reasons. But again, that goes back to one of the first questions you asked about testing, what we just talked about, was if you can't prove that that contaminant level in there is due to drilling, and that goes back to doing pre-drilling testing.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, is there even a level that's been a standard with a primary MCL? Does that even exist? Without those things, they can't prove anything, and it gets really difficult for them to do anything.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very difficult problem for the individuals. Of course, industry, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do, and from my perspective, it seems like it's unlikely that there's going to be legislation that's going to stop the process anytime soon. So it's really an awareness that you're raising here, and people have to make choices based on, you know, the information they're given.
Yeah, that's true. You're absolutely right. It's very unlikely that it will be stopped, but I think we need to, you know, really look into it more carefully, because even in states where there's no way that it's going to stop, certainly I'm sure there are ways of doing things more safely and protecting people better than has been in the past.
Right. Now, that brings me to the last question I'd like to ask both of you. You probably have some idea of how different states are handling the issue. It seems, at least from the way that the industry here in Colorado presents it, is that it's a leading state. They're, you know, the trailblazer as far as safety and, you know, this kind of thing. So I don't know if that's the truth or not, but I just ask you if you have followed a bit of what's been going on in various states and if you have a comment on that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true what you say about Colorado. It's also true about every other state. Every state in the union that has hydraulic fracturing has the best regulation in the country. That, I'm joking.
I kind of thought so.
But we actually hear that.
We've heard that everywhere. We've heard that in England. We've heard it everywhere. The fact of the matter is that none of the states have ideal regulations. Some of them are better than others. Certainly Pennsylvania is not the best.
Uh-huh.
Colorado has some problems. All the states need to do better.
Would there be a one that kind of lies at the bottom as far as, you know, they've kind of cozied up to industry and really are, you know, blocking attempts to try to do greater safety measures?
I think that would have to be West Virginia. They seem to have a lot of difficulty protecting the environment. That's not to say that there are, in fact, some really wonderful people there that are working hard to improve the not only the regulatory environment, but the natural environment there. It's a wonderful, beautiful state, but it has been mined and drilled for so many years, and it's unlikely that the regulatory system there will improve anytime soon.
Okay. Michelle, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that, well, one state that stands out in my mind is Arkansas. I have we have a case there, and it's a case where the people have tried to work with their within their political system, and I have been sent documentation on what's gone on and what's been said, and I've been shocked about how some of the politicians have responded and how they do seem to be right up there in there with industry, and this is what they want. So I can only hope that even in that state that this small group of people, concerned citizens banding together trying for change, will eventually do something, and I think that's the message of hope that we want to send out there to people who may be listening to this and who may be in one of these states is to get together with other like-minded citizens, make sure that everyone's getting the facts, and try to work with your politicians. But I'd work on the local, state, and national level. Work on all of those levels because you need to reach out as much and as far as possible if we're going to make change.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I have to appreciate your effort here because it is, as Robert said, a David and Goliath situation. So regardless of how, you know, it all comes out in the wash, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, somebody is raising, you know, the argument for the other side. And, you know, I commend you both for that. The book is called The Real Cost of Fracking, and it's written by Michelle Bamberger and Robert Oswald. So you two, I really appreciate your sharing a wealth of knowledge, and good luck with the endeavor on the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.